Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, March 21st. I'm Ray Graff. Time once again for the Science Forum, and we have a great trio of scientists here to answer your questions. So if you have a scientific question that has you stumped, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you may email us at voxpop@wamc.org. That's voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number, 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum. Your call's coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today we reconvene the Science Forum, and the experts are here. They are champing at the bit to answer your science questions. The number is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551, or you can email us, for Pete's sake. It's voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org. But again, that number, 800-348-2551. If you have a vexing science question, and I see we have at least one right now already, give us a call. Let's have our team of scientists sign in, please.
Good afternoon. It's Barbara Brabetz. I'm a biochemist from SUNY Cobleskill.
I'm Jim Pickett. I'm an organic chemist, and I'm mostly retired.
Oh, you're back.
I'm back.
You've been away for a while.
Well, just for a little while. Right. I missed the show last month.
Nice to have you back on the show.
And I'm Ed Stander, and I'll answer anything that Barbara or Jim cannot answer, or Pete for that matter.
And what is your technical field of expertise?
Geology, astronomy, and the really neat stuff.
Okay, fair enough. Well, great to have you all here. Some disturbing news. I guess, you know, the solar flare coming, and we'll all be zapped out of existence, right?
Yes, Ray, that's correct.
When did that happen?
There was a couple coronal mass ejections yesterday that are headed this way. So the actual gases will get here, I think, late tonight and tomorrow.
Ooh.
Electronic pulse that happened has already hit us.
Ah, so no big problem.
There was ham radio. Shortwave radio was disturbed for quite a while.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But the grid survived and things like that.
Well, I can never tell if I lose my cell signal because I just live in oblivion or if it's really a solar flare.
And you're in a Faraday cage at work anyway, right?
I am. We had a follow-up email actually after that, after our Faraday cage discussion last time.
And so when you're at work, none of the kids, their cell phones won't work.
Not in my office.
That's
great. It actually is a blessing. You know that they're not really looking at much at their phone if they're in class. We have this one room that's a windowless room in the middle of our building. So it's got lots of concrete and lots of rebar between them and the outside. And they have a devil of a time trying to get anything.
But they try anyway, don't they?
Well, they try going the Wi-Fi route. But, yeah. You know, I have my ways.
Turn off the Wi-Fi.
I know where the thing is.
And Jim Pickett, you had mentioned before we started an interesting study. And I actually read a little bit about this either today or yesterday, about humans' ability to perceive magnetic fields.
Yeah. I first saw this in one of the science YouTube channels I subscribed to, Veritasium, and then it was on the science news site today. So they put people in this room, much like this studio, with coils to generate magnetic fields, and varied the magnetic fields and measured the response of brain waves, particularly the alpha waves, and found that in a number of people anyway, the brain waves responded to changes in the magnetic field. And this was on the same kind of strength of a field as the Earth's magnetic field. But they could move it around without moving the person, so that eliminated confusion from, you know, the inner ear sloshing around.
Mechanical motion,
To tell the direction. But it's a pretty weak signal. And it's not surprising that people are able to do this. Many animals and birds can. Bacteria can. To my mind, what's kind of remarkable is that it's such a weak effect and doesn't appear to be conscious at all.
But not many of us migrate. That could be a reason.
Well, mean, our ancestors moved around a lot, and
we all have GPS now.
Yeah, we all have GPS.
Really don't need it. But could you train that now that we can see that there is an observable effect? And they, I guess they had a control group of 100 and 100 yeah. people being the magnetic fields were being moved around. And so theoretically, you could train a person then to be more tuned to this, right?
Possibly, yeah. It may be that, I mean, this was done in a room in the dark, in the quiet. It may be that other sensory phenomenon just kind of swamp it out in the real world. Mm.
Well, it's interesting because we have people who are diviners who do divining rods,
yeah.
look for water underground, and they've shown that it isn't the stick you pick. Like, they've done studies on picking the stick, right? You have to have a green stick that has some water content in it.
Right.
At least this is the lore that goes with the divining rod.
Yeah.
But it seems to be the diviners themselves that have this tendency. And from what I've read, it does seem to be a manipulation of the magnetic field on a really small level that these people are picking up.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, it gets to be worse, though, because the magnetic field is moving towards Russia, which means that Mother Russia is the place to go if you have an effect.
Or where all the water will go.
That's right.
The number here is 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum. Ed Stander, Barbara Roberts, and Jim Pickett are here to answer your questions. And let's take a couple of questions before our first break. Rich in Niskayuna. Rich, you're on.
Hi. I have a quick question. It's been an ongoing family squabble at my house. Do fish sneeze?
Do fish sneeze?
That's it.
Okay.
Well, do fish have knees, but do they sneeze?
Do they sneeze?
Do they sneeze?
I really don't
now,
think.
Now, we did go to the Boston Aquarium, and I stumped the resident person that was answering questions, and he said he'd get back to me, and he never did. So I'm expecting better.
Well, I hope you're not disappointed, Rich. Let's find out.
I mean, I would imagine fish can spit, you know, in a way, but sneezing sort of requires air passing through.
Right, you need an air passage to then reverse, and so their nose is not it.
Yeah, so I think sort of by definition, no.
Can they sneeze through the gills?
Well, again, there's no air.
Okay.
Right, so what are you going to eject?
Water?
Gills? You're moving the gills to keep the water flowing across the gills in order to absorb the oxygen, which is in pretty low concentration in the water to begin with. You know, the whole thing with sharks, the lore is that because they can't move their gills, that they have to keep moving in order to keep breathing, right, to keep the motion past the gills. But is there a sphincter to push backwards? I don't think so. I think only the spit. I think you got spit, but no sneeze.
Maybe, you know, when you sneeze, what you're doing is expelling air. So if you were to look at the fish and see them moving backwards all of a sudden, then you'd be able to tell they're sneezing.
But no bubbles, no sneeze.
No bubbles, no sneeze.
Right. Well,
no bubbles, no sneeze.
That's what you get for free on the Science Forum. So you had to at least pay admission to get to the aquarium.
Boy, you really got us off to a great start, Rich. I really appreciate it.
I was going to say, worth every penny I paid for the opinion.
Okay, well, thanks a lot. It's downhill from here. 800-348-2551 is the number. Harvey in Altamont. Harvey, you're on.
Thank you. My understanding is space is a vacuum, so if you were to yell, no one would hear you, correct?
If space is a vacuum. Yep. If you were to yell, no one would hear you. Yes.
Yes.
Okay. So when these giant stars explode, is that like one giant silent movie?
Well,
you can't hear them explode?
Yeah, to a good extent it would be. You wouldn't hear any sound, but what will happen is you can get gravity waves developing as a result of that. In other words, the structure of space and time itself actually starts to be affected by it. You wouldn't hear anything unless, of course, you got on Earth and one of these gravity waves passed by and you produce a sound by the gravity wave passing by. But if you're standing out there, you certainly wouldn't hear anything.
What sort of a sound would a gravity wave passing by on Earth sound like?
Well, effectively, what would happen is the space would sort of decrease and then increase a little bit. So if you had, for example, a record going, the record would go, but it would be so fast that you probably wouldn't even hear it.
Huh.
It's kind of like talking into a circular box fan. You get that, right? Because you're compressing and decompressing, compressing and decompressing. Mm. It's that same phenomenon, only at a much different level.
Very, very small level. You probably right. You'd never notice it, but that's what would happen.
What if you were really close, Ed, right before the gravity waves hit
then
you?
Then you'd be dead.
It would just kind of crush you into oblivion. Right. And then the expansion would never happen because there's nothing left.
What do you think, Harvey?
Well, how close can you get, I guess? I mean, if we're like on a space station or somewhere out there, one of these things explodes, or as close as you can get without being incinerated or obliterated by these waves, which are really sort of like, I don't know, I mean, the gravity waves, I guess, but you wouldn't actually hear anything then.
No,
so this great big huge explosion would be going on and you wouldn't hear a thing.
Well, it's not just that, but it takes a while for one of these things to explode. They don't just go poof. So it gets
right.
It effectively gets bigger, and then it gets very small as it compresses itself, and then it expands outwards. So it would take a little while for you to actually probably notice that it was happening.
To alleviate a little confusion here, a star exploding actually isn't going to generate much in the way of gravity waves. Its mass is moving around each other. Mm. So two black holes coalescing, or neutron stars, but just a star going kafoof isn't going to generate gravity waves.
Well, it will, but probably much smaller than we'll be able to measure.
Much smaller.
It's the Science Forum on Vox Pop. The number is 800-348-2551. Barbara Brabets, Jim Pickett, and Ed Stander are here. You are there. You call us at 800-348-2551, and we'll be back. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you. It's the Science Forum today. Barbara Brabets, Ed Stander, and Jim Pickett are here. And Barbara Brabets, you'll be presenting some papers at the Mohawk Watershed Symposium at Union College tomorrow.
Spring break. This is wonderful.
This is what you do on your spring
break? This is my spring break.
You are a party animal.
Oh, gosh. Can you believe it?
Tell us about it.
Yes. Well, we partner, SUNY Cobleskill faculty and students partner with SUNY Poly and also Riverkeeper. And we have compiled 4 years worth of water quality sampling and data on the Mohawk River from the confluence of the Mohawk with the Hudson all the way out past Rome to the headwaters. And our results will be presented. We've collected over 900 samples at 40 plus spots.
Over 4 years.
Okay. And, you know, one sample doesn't tell the story because it's just a blip in time. It's kind of like looking at your child's mood on an afternoon. They could be having a good day. They could be having a bad day.
Yeah.
All right, Ray knows about that.
You
so
betcha.
So you really need to look at overall what's going on. And for the most part, the river has responded well to recent investments in infrastructure that we've seen with sewage treatment plants getting upgrades in the Utica area, with certain pipes being replaced in a lot of the major cities on the east side of the Mohawk. But we do have one location in particular besides Utica, and that is a 4-mile stretch pretty much from Half Moon towards the confluence with the Hudson River, where the water quality still is highly impacted, and we haven't quite divined why, but we know that, yes, it's definitely impacted.
Impacted by what chemical, presumably?
Oh, well, we're only looking for sewage. We're
only
looking
sewage.
For bacteria. And our assumption is it's coming from human, wildlife, and farm runoff, and then also some surface water runoff when it rains. And we see a significantly worse response at the river level when it rains versus when it doesn't rain. So this is where our septic systems and our sewage treatment plants are being overwhelmed, where we have combined sewer outfalls that are meant to overflow into the river when we have too much water, and then generally surface water runoff that's contaminated with whatever beast has done its deed. So we'll be presenting those data tomorrow, my colleagues and I, and
I think we'll hear more about that on this station, I have a feeling.
I have a feeling you might, yes.
Our number here on the Science Forum is 800-348-2551. Barbara Bravitz, Jim Pickett, and Ed Stander are here to answer your questions. And we go to our old buddy Jim in North Pownell, Vermont. Hello, Jim.
Hey, Ray.
Hey.
Great, great show. You spend too much time promoting WAMC, but
what?
I'm not going to go there.
What the heck now? What? Okay, all right. You go ahead with your question.
My question is about a Juglans dieback. It's a fungal disease that attacks black walnuts and butternuts, and I'm just wondering if anybody can chime in and tell me that there's some organic way to control it.
Well, I think the gardening show with Fred Breglia,
is actually coming up.
Yeah.
Fred Breglia, the arborist, would be able to.
He's the definite one for that. And Fred, if you're out there listening.
I got three scientists on the line.
Yes, but none of us are botanists, dear. That's for sure.
Okay.
One thing I can tell you about fungus is it's promoted by humidity. So I doubt you can control the humidity around your black walnut or your butternut.
Believe me, I know that.
Yeah. So a lot of the fungal diseases are on the rise because we're having wetter summers.
Well, I'll tell you what, Jim, if you get in line, and I don't know, I think the gardening show might be next week. I'm not sure. But if you get in line for that show, I'll make sure you get on there first and you can ask that question to Fred.
All right, and as far as E. coli goes, I'd love the answer that you put out.
Okay. Oh, about the runoff?
Yeah, sewage and runoff and stuff like that.
We look for both E. coli and another bacterium called Enterococcus, which is kind of its kissing cousin.
You guys are so great, it's not even funny.
Well, Jim,
you're a
positive influence on this program, Jim. Thank you for Ed's patting himself on the back now. There you go. See, you've done it. Let's go to Mark in Salem. Mark, you're on.
Hi, Ray. The rooster's not crowing at the moment.
Oh, terrific.
I am a physicist by training, astronomer, mathematician. I mean, and I'm 67 years old, and I've been around, and I am always amazed at the business of dowsing for water.
Yeah.
My great-grandfather taught me, and I have found underwater sources where there weren't supposed to be any. My neighbor was an engineer at the General Electric, and he used a whole different technique, and he was able to trace water lines in his orchard, and 2 feet down he'd find. Is it because of the difference in the? I know that H2O has a positive and negative side. Is there something to do with that? I'm a non-believer, and yet I can still do it.
Huh, interesting.
Well, I'll tell you from my perspective is that there are very few places in the Northeast where you can't dig down and find water. There are a couple situations where, for example, glaciers had come through and there were certain areas where there's more water and less water. But it's pretty rare that you find a place where it's impossible to find water going down, or at least around here. If you were able to do some good dowsing, for example, in a limestone area where the water is only found within caves, and you're able to prove that works, then I would be ecstatic to know it.
Well, that's where I'm talking about. My well, I doused it, and it was slate on top, and below that was limestone. I said the water is going to be down about 400 feet, and sure enough, at 425, they hit mountainous amounts of water. I can't accept the results, but my great grandfather found a well on our first property that would supply the city of Schenectady, and he showed me, and I've seen it, I've done it, and I really can't. I mean, using the old, you know, the sticks with a apple or cherry or a fruit tree. I've seen it done with a plumb bob and a car antenna, and I had a map on my parents' property in 1967, where I gave the neighbor the map, and I took the map, and we both found all nine places on the property, and we picked the best one, and that was the one that had the water.
But you're a skeptic, Mark, and yet you can do it. So let's go around.
Yeah.
Let's talk to our panel here, and then we'll move on. Barbara Brabets, what's your opinion?
Well, we've had dowsing questions before, so I had this as a homework, I'd say half a decade ago. And at that time, and I haven't kept up on my dowsing literature.
Okay.
At the time, they had debunked the rod itself, that it was not a rod phenomenon, that it seemed to be the human phenomenon. And the supposition, it was not proven, it was only a theory, was that it was a magnetic line variation that people were sensing in some way.
Okay. But then couldn't you find something else that would disturb the magnetic field?
Sure. Right.
You know,
but we're looking for quantity, right?
Okay. No, but we're also looking 400 feet down in this case.
Yeah.
And the chances of having any effect from something that's 400 feet down in a limestone below clay would be very, very difficult to believe.
Yeah. And I'm highly skeptical. It's just that so many other things could swamp out any small effect that water would have on a magnetic field. And power lines would entirely swamp it.
Okay, but this is logical, and so it makes sense, and you could say yes. But then there are those people who have done it, or at least presumably done it. Mark's great-grandfather, for instance, before there were a lot of power lines.
To Ted's point, you find water in most places, and you don't hear about when they say dig here and
they don't
come
do
up
it.
With a dry well.
Could they go to Oak Island and try to find that treasure?
Oh, boy.
You know, the dowsers?
Yeah, they could.
That would be fun. Hey, they haven't done that yet. But let's go to... Oh, let's not go to that line. Let's go to Steve in Pine Bush. Hello.
Hi. So I have a PhD in comparative anatomy, and I'm one of the foremost authorities on fish anatomy in the United States.
Wow. So okay. Well, welcome aboard.
I think I can answer the sneeze question.
Okay.
Your panelists are right, but for the wrong reason.
Okay.
Just assume that if humans were underwater and their lungs were filled with water, they would sneeze water out the nose because the lungs would fill with water.
Yeah.
In the fishes, there's no direct connection between the opening of the nose and any of the digestive system or the mouth.
All right.
Correct.
And so there's no way to force water out the nose.
All right.
Or air out the nose in the fishes.
Yeah, it's just a nose. That's all it does.
It's a blind-ending sac.
Yep.
And that blind-ending sac, although it could sense an irritant that might initiate a sneeze, they don't have any way to contract the sac to force the air back, to force the water back out.
Ah, but can they geese?
So they can't sneeze.
Can they geese?
What's that?
Can they geese through their gills?
There are numerous. All fish can force water that they've brought in through the gills. They can force that water back out through the mouth. In fact, you see that in goldfish all the time.
Mm-hmm.
They will take a little piece of gravel from the bottom of a fish tank into their mouth.
Yeah.
And they'll throw it back out by squirting water.
Ah.
Steve, when you were doing your PhD, did you think this question would ever come up?
Not when I was doing my PhD, but I'm in my middle 60s now. I did my PhD a long time ago. But 10 years ago, I was involved in putting together an atlas of anatomy of the zebrafish, which is a very popular research animal
right now.
Yes,
it is. Yep.
Okay. Well, Steve, hey, thanks a lot for clearing that up. And I got to say, it's been one weird program thus far.
Well, we figured one out then, or at least Steve figured it out for us.
This is why it's important to have people on hand who really know what they're talking about. Here's another Steve. This one's in Albany. Hello, Steve.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm all right. How are you?
Great. The question is, I recently read an article that said something about the moon being within Earth's atmosphere, something called a geocorona. And quite honestly, I'd always thought of the Earth being outside of the Earth. The moon being outside of the Earth's atmosphere. So what's this geocorona? Where did it come from?
Well, I can tell you that the Earth's atmosphere goes up about 50 miles. Once you get past there, there's a certain amount of particles, if you want, or molecules of atmosphere that can continue out, but there's not enough to actually call it an atmosphere. Mm. So, for example, if you see a meteor come in, when the meteor first hits the atmosphere, it starts to heat up. That's about 50 miles up. Okay, above that, there's not enough to cause friction. And therefore, it's really the atmosphere.
Have we heard the term geocorona before? Could he be talking about a magnetosphere?
I was actually, because it says corona in it, I was thinking maybe it's within the Earth shine, and that's where the corona comes from, that you could get the reflection of light from, or the transmission of light from Earth to the moon, and the moon could be somewhat lit by that.
Yeah, but in terms of how we would defined atmosphere of being air molecules around. No, it's way outside.
All right, Steve, thanks for the call.
Which is a good thing. Otherwise, we would probably lose it because frictional drag would make it crash into us.
Yeah.
The number here is 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum with Jim Pickett, Barbara Brabets, and Ed Stander. And if you have a question, this is the time to call. We go over to Frank in Waterville. Frank!
Yes, hello, Ray and fellows and scientists. Thank you for taking my call. And this is true, even though it's about goldfish, it has nothing to do with the call that just came.
Okay.
When I was younger, I always wondered because I'd be watching my goldfish swimming around, and then they would stop, and for some reason they would take their mouths and open them up wide as if they were yawning, and nothing came out. Huh. And I was just wondering, does anyone have any idea why they might have done that?
Okay.
I've always wondered about it.
Do goldfish yawn?
Well, I can tell you just to start off with that if you're spending your life inside of a tank watching human beings, I would be yawning too.
Yeah. Okay.
Do they socially yawn is the real question. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Like turtles.
Yes.
I wonder if any goldfish are yawning right about now.
And we lost our fish comparative anatomist, so that's a darn shame.
Yeah, that's a shame, Frank. I don't know.
There's a lot of gill action that goes on. They have to make sure that they dispel material from their gills. Imagine you got a piece of nut stuck in your gum. You have hands, right? You can go in there and kind of get it out. But fish only has the ability to manipulate its jaw and its head in order to get these materials out.
Yeah.
So. Well, who knows? They could just be making fun of us. It could be like a social cue that they think we're jerks. And
it's like
the middle finger from a fish to us.
You might want to stand by the fish and just start telling old stories or something.
Yeah, or just turn the radio up real loud after the next break. Hey, Frank, thank you for that one. Hey, let's take a break, Zach the Engineer, before anything else happens. 800-348-2551 is the number. 800-348-2551. Sometimes you wake up in the morning, you say, maybe I won't go into work, and then you do, and then you regret it. And here we are. We'll be back. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you. It's a scintillating edition of the Science Forum. Ed Stander, Jim Pickett, and Barbara Brabets are here, and we'll get back to the phones in a minute. We have some emails, and let's see what they say. This one is from Dee in Suffield, Connecticut. Dee writes, I've always wanted to ask the science experts this question. I have a Himalayan salt lamp, not because I believe in the health benefits, but because I think they're pretty. I've read that they emit harmful radiation, so I have reluctantly packed it away for another time, hoping I will hear that they are completely safe. What's the verdict, please? And that's from D in Suffield.
They're completely safe unless you have a sodium allergy.
So what's a Himalayan salt lamp?
It's a lamp made with a lamp inside that heats up a big mass of orangish Himalayan salt.
Yeah.
Which is otherwise known as sodium chloride.
Yeah.
With a certain amount of coloring in it, properly potassium.
I see.
And so it really doesn't do anything. a certain amount of the sodium will go out of the environment as it heats up, but that's about it.
Okay.
Actually, I don't think any of the sodium would go out into the environment. I mean, they're supposed to give, it's touted that they give off ions, but ions do not like to be in the gas phase. So I don't think that
What about my depleted uranium lamp? Is that bad?
I think you might want to not be naked near it.
All right.
It doesn't get much light out of it.
If anyone's worried, I really don't have one.
There you go. Don't ask a geologist.
This one's from Kevin in Goshen. Are the eyelid muscles in a state of rest while in the open position or in the closed position? Seems odd to have to constantly use energy to keep our eyes in the open position. And then again, the same thing could be said for using energy to keep our eyelids closed, like while sleeping. And that's from Kevin in Goshen.
That's a great question. We've never had that one before. It's actually an intermediate is the resting state. So if you think about like the movies where somebody dies and their eyes are kind of like half closed but not fully closed, and then somebody pushes them down or puts pennies on them or whatever to keep them closed. So that kind of mid-lax state is the natural relaxed state. So not completely open, not completely closed. Okay. So it takes energy both ways.
Fair enough. This one is from Marion Delmar. It's well known that global warming is having huge meteorological impacts. Does climate change also have an impact on the incidence and severity of geological disasters like earthquakes, volcanic eruptions, and landslides? If so, how, why does it influence those things? That's from Mary in Delmar.
Well, basically, it has no effect. As far as I'm concerned, as far as I can see, there's no effect of global warming except if you, for example, have large amounts of water going onto a surface and actually depressing it. But generally speaking, there'd be no effect.
She threw
landslides in there, and that's the red herring.
Yeah.
That one's definitely influenced by global climate change.
Yep, that would be. And, of course, glaciation, if it ever comes back, would also affect the Earth as well.
All right, bring back glaciation.
This one's from Daniel in the last email, and then we'll get back to the phones. Are radio waves analogous to sound waves in that there's radio waves all around us, but we don't hear them without the appropriate receiver? So, with no eardrums, are sound waves also silent? Does the old adage of a tree falling in the forest have a bit of truth to it?
Well, people can actually hear sound waves with various bones in their body. In fact, there's a very famous timpanist who plays drums, and she's tuned very parts of her body to actually hear the sounds. So while she can't hear it through her ear, she can hear it elsewhere. And right behind your ear, there's a bone which is very strongly affected by sound waves. So you can actually pick it up without having an eardrum.
Yes, and also if you've ever been to a rock concert and been in front of a big speaker, you can feel the concussion of the disturbance of the air, the compression and expansion of the air, which is really how sound is propagated, into your chest. So yes, you can feel sound waves even if you can't hear. Radio waves are much more like light than they are like sound in that they're complete energy and can propagate even in a vacuum.
All right, so Zach the engineer, do me a favor, open up the talkback mic and have our call screener, Joe Makowitz, tell me what the hell he's gesticulating about. I have no idea. Just what is it? Something's going on. I can't hear. Zach?
Thank you.
Okay.
Evelyn Glennie.
All right, thank you very much. And I don't know.
She is the timpanist from Scotland.
Wow, Joe, thank you for that one. Joe Makowitz, our call screener, is providing. You want to come in, and then we'll switch. How about that? I'll screen the calls, or I'll just go to OTB. Let's go over to Lawrence in Rockland. Lawrence, you're on.
Yes, I have a pacemaker defibrillator, and I was wondering if the solar flares would affect that. They say it's affected by TV radios, high tension lines, car alternators, and magnets and stuff like that. It's actually encased in a titanium case.
Well, fortunately, we have what's called a magnetosphere around the Earth, and most effects of solar flares wind up being blocked, if you will, by the magnetosphere, so that very little of it actually gets to the Earth. At times, if the flare is strong enough, it can push the magnetosphere close to the Earth, and we can wind up getting relatively strong electric signals, but certainly no stronger than what you'd get, for example, from ground waves or from high tension lines.
The reason I was wondering is lately my my beats per minute on my defibrillator have been going off the charts both ways, up and down.
Well, yikes. We're actually in a solar minimum right now. And the amount of flares coming from the sun are very, very few. That's why this one is making some headlines. And even this solar flare is probably going to miss us. If we get it, it's just going to be a glancing blow.
It is a glancing blow.
Correct. Lawrence, thank you for the call. Now, as I understand it, it really is a question of polarization with these coronal mass ejections. In other words, if they're the right polarization compared to our magnetic field,
yes,
then we could get zapped, but otherwise they just get tossed aside.
Well, they're stronger if the magnetic pole, for example, is pointing towards the direction of the sun when they hit. So it all depends in that respect. But besides that, there's really not much of an effect. And it's very rare that they have that much of an effect on the Earth.
There's only been a handful of times.
We've seen the one in the late 1800s where the telegraph wires were literally burning up.
Skitching off. Everything was just kind of crackling. There's only, as I was saying, only a handful of times that that's happened in all of our so-called modern times.
However, the next time it does happen, a lot of damage will be done.
Well, in the 1960s, that's what blew the generators out in the Midwest that turned the entire northeast of the United States dark.
Correct.
So it can happen.
And they've, of course, done tests on electromagnetic pulse. I believe that the series of atmospheric or space-based nukes, I think it was Starfish Prime, was the test they did. And I mean, there were some serious EMP issues in Hawaii and elsewhere.
Yeah. They fried a lot of electronics and decided that probably wasn't a great idea.
All right, back to the phones we go at 800-348-2551. Kathy in Thurman. Kathy, you're on.
Hey, guys. How are you?
Good.
Okay, so I'm curious. My husband and I listen to AMC and other NPR stations around the clock. We don't listen to anything else. And sometimes the radio comes in really good, and sometimes it's really crackly, and my husband and I will walk past it, and it'll automatically come in better. Why is that?
Ray does this one.
No, go you ahead, guys, Ray. Go ahead. You're the scientist.
You're an antenna.
Kathy, you're an antenna.
I'm an antenna.
Yeah.
Yep. I'm an antenna.
You're a liquid-filled antenna.
Why is that?
Because your liquid ain't pure. Because you have ions that your water and ions and a bunch of other stuff and, you know, whatever else makes up you. And that encased in an individual is an antenna.
Yeah. So sometimes it works for my husband and not me and vice versa.
Well, part of it has to do with, well, there's really two things. The first is that you're grounding the antenna as you get close to it, much as the way that my theremin does the same thing. Mm. If I come close to it, I'm wind up.
So that's inductance?
It's inductance. And that depends to a good extent on the amount of water in the environment. If it's a very wet day or you're in an environment that's relatively wet, then you'll have a better effect on it than you would otherwise.
And it really is going to be more noticeable on weak signals, Kathy. So I assume that you're in a spot where AMC comes in 60%.
We're out
maybe?
In the middle of Thurman.
Thurman. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Mountains around you.
Well, exactly.
And then, of course, when the leaves start sprouting, then you have another problem.
Right.
Exactly. Well, we've got a Bose, so, I mean, we get a lot more stations better than they were, but it's a struggle.
Outside antenna will work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've got that, too.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Curious, is your husband more of like a palm sweaty person than you are?
Is that a legitimate question?
It's a legit question. Okay. She said that she walks by it and it doesn't do it.
So he's got a lot of salt water is what you mean?
So he might just be he must have a little bit more gain to him.
Huh.
Do you use moisturizer?
Yes.
You could end up dampening your signal by the moisturizer that you use.
Okay.
Really? Well, Kathy, thank you. That was a great question. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Thanks, guys.
Have a good one. Okay, well, let's find out what's next. Jay and Hadley. Jay, you're on. Hello? Jay? Oh, for Pete's sake. He waits for 22 minutes, and then he's not there. I'm sorry, Jay. If you call back, we'll try to get you right through. Laura in New Paltz. Laura, you're on.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
I think I'm having an episode. Hey, Laura, I tell you what, let's put you on hold. Are you there now?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Oh, no, it sounds terrible. It sounds like you're playing through a Fender amp that has a tremolo on it. And so
only Ray would say that.
What could go wrong now? Ken in Hurleyville. Ken, you're on.
Hello, thank you. I think Laura had too much moisturizer on.
You see? Might be right. Well played.
I was wondering, Earth's polar shift, I've heard about that. I don't even know if it's true.
It's true.
And if it's true, would that affect the weather, global warming, et cetera?
No, it would affect space weather. In other words, things coming in from outer space, perhaps, solar flares and such. But as far as the Earth is concerned, it would have very little
effect. And that happens over the grand scheme of things all the time.
Right. Yeah. It is moving quite fast. As I say, I think the Russians have a giant magnet, and they're pulling it towards them.
That's not true.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I do, like the South Pole, they have to move where the pole is every year, not the magnetic pole, but the true pole. And I was reading an article in Antarctica, which is my passion to do that, to read about Antarctica. I should eventually just go there.
Yeah.
But it was a 33-foot shift from last year.
Huh.
For the actual pole.
Right. And that happens because earthquakes and tremors and all sorts of things happening on the ocean floor especially actually make things move around a bit.
Well, there you go, Ken. Thanks for that one. 800-348-2551, the number. We go to Elaine in Olive Bridge. Elaine, you're on.
Hello.
Hello.
I'd like to talk a little bit about dowsing because I do dowsing for a living. I'm a professional dowser,
okay.
And I've dowsed many, many wells, and as well as working with energies. And I'd like to comment on the magnetic field, and I think that's what dowsers are picking up.
Okay.
That they use a tool to do it with because it's just more, it's easier to focus your mind on it.
Okay.
And about the water, the dowser's premise is that water flows in veins, and I tend to believe that because there has been incidences where you'll go where somebody has drilled, like this is true, 900 feet, and they have no water, and then you can go about 3 or 4 feet away and find water at 200 feet. So I guess the dowser's premise is that everything flows in veins, sort of like the human body, where you have veins in your human body, rather than like aquifers and everybody can go down to a certain depth and you'll get something. And I agree with the rock, limestone, and different rocks carry water differently, but I've also been to places where they have pockets of salt water and gases and things like that people have in their well. So the you know, we try to find clean water, and it's by asking those questions in your mind, you're posing the question in your mind of what you're looking for, and the answer is very basic, yes or no.
Okay. Anybody on the panel want to weigh in here?
She's an expert.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Elaine. That was very good. Appreciate the call. Quickly over to Bob in Wilbraham, Mass. Bob, you're on. Oh, hello, Bob. Are you there? For Pete's sake. Hello, Bob.
We talked too much about solar flares. Look what's going on.
Oh, my gosh. John on the Northway. John.
Hi. How are you doing, guys?
Good.
Hey, I just... more of an observation than anything else. It just seems like when I was a kid, winter used to start about mid-November and go to, you know, towards the middle of March. It just seems as though that has kind of shifted later in the year by 3 or 4 weeks. Is that my imagination? Is that really happening? Is that a function of global warming?
So how old are you, Bob?
John,
sorry.
Jim.
And I'm 62.
All right.
Okay, so it was the 60s that you were a kid?
Yep.
Yep. That was, Ed, do you want to talk about the...
30-year cycle?
Yeah, the 30-year cycle, and that was a cycle of cooler weather.
Yeah, well, there's... The sun itself has effects, and there are numerous... currents underneath the sun, and these add or subtract to each other And as a result, you have periods of time when it's cooler, periods of time when it's warmer. And for example, it's now pretty well certain that between about 2030 and 2050, it's going to start to cool off again. So there are these large scale changes that occur on a relatively short basis.
But I mean, memory is a tricky thing too.
Yeah, but the fact is that the seasons have changed some.
Yeah.
Relative to the way that it was in the
certainly the birds know
in
it
the 60s. Yeah. Right.
The birds know it. The insects know it. And actually, the gardeners know it because the zone designations for upstate New York have changed and become more tropical by at least a number of one.
Let's go to Reed in North Greenbush. Reed, you're on.
Yes. I have a machining background, so I'm familiar with alloys of steel and how carbon plays with iron. And I know that manganese alloys with aluminum, but then I run across this fact that aluminum is the third most plentiful substance in aluminum's everywhere.
That's
and
right.
I thought to myself, what is aluminum locked up with? And it's so hard to extract. And so that's my question.
Okay, good question.
The aluminum is locked up with oxygen. It forms aluminum oxide, which is actually a soil, laterite, for example. And when laterite sort of congeals to a rock, it's called bauxite. And the problem is it's almost impossible to zap the oxygen off the aluminum. So what they normally have to do is put the aluminum oxide into a big vat of what's called cryolite and then blast it with about 150,000 watts of electricity.
Wow.
A huge amount. Yeah, so this is why most aluminum smelters are next to hydroelectric plants.
Right. It's so electrically dependent. And that's why recycling aluminum is enormously beneficial because of the energy needed to extract it from
that is really amazing. That's a good way to end the program. A very interesting science forum today. Thanks to Barbara Brabets, Ed Stander, and Jim Pickett for being here. Support comes from Merritt Bookstore, Millbrook, in the heart of Millbrook. Let's start that again. Jeez, I'll tell you what, it's time to retire. Merritt Bookstore, Millbrook, an independent book and toy store in the heart of Millbrook, offering kites and books about local hikes for the upcoming spring season. MerrittBookstore.com. Empire Exhibits and Displays, Mechanicville, New York, supplying the greater capital region with custom display solutions, commercial casework, and interactive exhibits for trade shows, special events, and museum exhibitions. EmpireExhibits.com. And Saratoga Jewish Community Arts presenting Rosenwald, a film about Julius Rosenwald, building over 5,000 schools, March 24th at Skidmore College, 518-584-8730. Well, thanks again to Barbara, Ed, and Jim for being here. Thank you for listening for some terrific questions today. Very strange program, and I appreciate that. Zach Malloy is our engineer. Joe Makowicz took the calls. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. I'm going to retire. Larry, the intern, will be doing Food Friday tomorrow. It's all about seafood. Right now, stand by for news.